Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 7th. It's Election Day. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local headlines from Fort Dodge. And our first headline today is election-related. It reads, Election Day is here. Webster County voters to decide on proposed jail, sheriff's office facility. Webster County voters are being asked today whether the county government should take out $45.5 million in general obligation bonds to construct a new facility for the Webster County Jail and Webster County Sheriff's Office. The question is listed under Webster County Public Measure versus on the ballot. For the last 2.5 years, Webster County Sheriff Luke Fleener has worked with a West Des Moines consulting firm to look into whether Webster County needs a new jail or law enforcement center to replace the current one located at 702 First Avenue South, giving periodic updates to the Webster County Board of Supervisors. The results of the study conducted by the Samuels Group were clear. The current Webster County Jail and Law Enforcement Center are not meeting the county's needs and, in fact, are a source of hemorrhaging money. The current jail has a capacity of 56 inmates, but the county averages 75 to 90 inmates in custody at any given time, Fleener previously told the Messenger. Because of this, Fleener has to rent space in other county jails to house Webster County's inmates, an expense costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. In the last 5 years, the county has spent $1.5 million in housing and transportation costs for these overflow inmates. For the current fiscal year, external housing costs for inmates account for $350,000 of the sheriff's office budget. The lack of space in the current jail also contributes to more than 1,000 individuals being unable to serve their jail sentences for various offenses, thus keeping those individuals' cases open in the courts until their sentences are discharged. The total number of days needing to be served is 7,398. Inmates serving sentences for convictions are required to pay $100 per day in housing costs. That's more than $750,000 that the Webster County Sheriff's Office has been unable to collect. The jail study also identified an array of safety liabilities caused by the condition of the existing aging jail. The proposed $45.5 million general obligation bonds include the cost of acquiring the land for a facility as well as the construction of the building. To preserve the negotiation process, the county has not yet approached any landowners to discuss purchasing their land for the project, Fleener said. He said several sites have been looked at as possibilities, but they won't begin the negotiation process until a bond referendum passes. Fleener has highlighted that the impact on property taxes for the proposed $45.5 million project would be spread over 20 years. Giving an example, he said a residential property with an assessed value of $100,000 and a taxable value of $52,000 would pay an additional $62.40 each year for a total of $1,248 over 2 decades. The WebsterCountyVote.com website allows residents to input their property's parcel number to learn exactly what the tax impact would be. Whether the bond referendum passes or not, Webster County taxpayers will be footing the bill for the cost of housing county inmates somewhere. It's just a matter of whether that taxpayer money will stay in Webster County. The design for the proposed new jail is for a 60,692-square-foot facility that would house both the jail and the sheriff's office. The jail would have 61 general population cells, double-bunked, and 8 special needs cells with one bunk, totaling 130 beds. The facility would also include space for jail administration, sheriff's office administration, patrol, investigations, and civil processing. And there's in today's paper also an article on where to vote in Webster County. And it includes a list. So if you live in Badger Cooper Newark Township, you would vote at the Badger Fire Station located at 150 First Avenue Southeast in Badger. If you live in the Burnside, Elkhorn, Otho, Pleasant Valley Summer Township, vote at the Otho Community Center located at 220 Rake Street in Otho. If you live in the Clay, Fulton, Johnson, Roland Township, you would vote at the Moreland Community Center, located at 416 3rd Street in Moreland. If you live in the Colfax, Hardin, Washington, Webster, Yell Township, you would vote at the Duncombe Community Center, located at 510 Folger Street in Duncombe. If you live in Dayton Township, vote at the Dayton Community Center, located at 104 1st Street Northwest in Dayton. If you live in Deer Creek, Jackson Township, you would vote at the Clare Community Center, located at 520 East Front Street in Clare. Fort Dodge District Number 1, you would vote at First Congregational Church of Christ at 1611 Williams Drive. Fort Dodge Number 2, First Presbyterian Church, located at 1111 5th Avenue North. Fort Dodge Numbers 3 and 6, the Lion's Den at Isaac Walton, located at 731 Exposition Drive. Fort Dodge Ward 4, or Township 4, and Douglas Township, First Covenant Church, 201 Avenue H. Fort Dodge Number 5, Prairie Lakes Church, located at 200 Avenue O. Fort Dodge Numbers 7 and 8, the Fort Dodge Municipal Building, located at 819 1st Avenue South. Fort Dodge Number 9, Prince of Peace Lutheran Church, located at 1023 South 27th Street. Fort Dodge Number 10, the Fort Dodge Community School District's office, located at 109 North 25th Street. Fort Dodge Number 11, the Church of Nazarene, located at 1250 North 24th Street. Fort Dodge Number 12, Trinity Methodist Church, located at 838 North 25th Street. And the Gowrie Lost Grove Township, you would vote at Gowrie Community Center, located at 1206 Market Street in Gowrie. And our next Fort Dodge headline reads, Songson never expected to make it out of Vietnam. The dateline is Stratford. Danny Songson will always know that 1968 was a leap year. For most people, that extra day was just another day at the end of February. For Songson, that meant one day more in South Vietnam. I was there a year and a day, Songson said. I got an extra day because it was a leap year. But at least he was getting out, just as the war was sinking to its lowest point. Songson had arrived in South Vietnam in the spring of 1967. In that year, U.S. casualties would nearly double, from 6,350 in 1966 to 11,363 in 1967. The year 1968 would be the deadliest of all, with 16,899 Americans killed. Songson counts himself lucky to have come home at all. He got his ticket out of South Vietnam in April 1968. The following month would be the single worst month of U.S. casualties of the entire war. I didn't think I was going to make it, Songson said. I didn't think I was ever going to get out. Songson, who grew up on a farm southeast of Stratford, said he would never let again the Army know up front that he was a farm boy comfortable with a gun. They liked farm boys, Songson said, and don't tell them you hunt and fish. You don't get to fish, but you do get to camp every night. I was a Boy Scout and all of that, and you just shouldn't tell them that when you're going in. They'll find out anyway. Songson was still a newlywed when he got his draft notice in the fall of 1966. I was renting a farm, had bought some machinery, and then Uncle Sam came calling with other plans. Soxon did his Army basic training at Fort Bliss, Texas, and then got a month at home at Christmas. It was a wild trip with fellow soldiers on a chartered bus for the long trip from Texas back to Iowa. He opted for a quieter ride on a train when it came time to head back to Fort Bliss. In his original testing with the military, Soxon had been identified as a candidate for mechanics schools, but that was not to be. At the last hour, they changed my orders, Soxon said. That was a bad day because I knew what was coming. I knew I was going to Vietnam. Soxon was sent for jungle training at Fort Polk, Louisiana. It was a place designed to prepare young men for the worst kind of warfare. The only good thing is that I was in good shape when I got out of there, Soxon said. We would run 5 miles every morning with 5-buckle overshoes on. It was still dark out when we got it done, and you would have the dry heaves waiting for breakfast. Nicknamed Tiger Lynn, the training at Fort Polk, now renamed Fort Johnson, was brutal and designed to prepare soldiers for even worse conditions when they reached South Vietnam. After a 30-day leave back in Stratford, Soxon shipped out from San Francisco on a 23-hour flight to South Vietnam. They had a stopover in Guam before arriving at Cam Ranh Bay, South Vietnam. They have to find a place clear across the world to fight, Soxon said. His stay in Cam Ranh Bay would be short-lived, just 2 or 3 days before literally being dropped into the middle of the fight. They put us on a helicopter and took us to the middle of the jungle near the Cambodian-Laos border. And that's where I was for the next 90 days, he said. Soxon was part of a rifle company in the 4th Infantry Division. Those first 3 months were spent in the jungle in extremely rough conditions. Every 3 days, they would bring us out 9 meals. That's all we got, Soxon said. We never seen a shower. We would wade in the rivers, sleep on the ground. We had a poncho for covering up and to keep some of the rain off of you. It was not a good thing. The battles were even worse. We were in big fights several nights, Soxon recalled. The Chinese were coming in over the border in big numbers. They finally put 3 of our companies together so we could get more people because they knew we were going to get attacked. Fatalities were high. But Soxon also remembers some brave survivors. A whole platoon had been wiped out one night, Soxon said. We went in and got those people out. There was one survivor. He had played dead all night because the Chinese were camped around him. That was a bad night. 3 months into his stint of jungle warfare, Soxon would get an important break when a fellow soldier was due to be helicoptered out for, of all things, a dental appointment. I had put in a request to be a mechanic, and I must have had a friend somewhere, Soxon said. Here comes a helicopter to get a guy who had to go to the dentist, and they took me too because they needed a mechanic. Vehicles weren't running, and I suppose some general didn't have a Jeep, so they grabbed me to be a mechanic. It was supposed to be a temporary assignment, and then back to the jungle, but Soxon is thankful that the rest of his tour would be spent as a mechanic at the 4th Infantry Division headquarters in Pleiku. So at least I had a cot to sleep in, a mess, a table to set at, and a concrete floor, Soxon said. We had a meal and a shower any time we wanted. It was 100 times better. Soxon was able to break up his time in Vietnam with 2 R&Rs in Hawaii. One of them came on very short notice. I couldn't even call my wife because we had to call over the radio from Vietnam, and you had to wait in line for hours, Soxon recalled. So I called her from Guam and told her that I was going to be in Hawaii in 8 hours, if there was any way she could meet me. And that's when small-town Stratford sprang into action. His then-wife was living in an upstairs apartment in Stratford and worked at the local grocery store. People were going up and down the street giving money so she could come to Hawaii, Soxon said. They got her to Des Moines, and she got a ticket. I got there first, but she got there the next day. Those were good memories, he said. When his tour in South Vietnam was finally over, he had his pick of duty and chose Fort Campbell, Kentucky, because he had family there. The couple had a small trailer on base, and his parents even came to visit. We were about 50 miles from Nashville and went to the Grand Ole Opry at Ryman Auditorium, he recalled. After his discharge, the couple returned to Stratford, where they would raise two sons and build a successful farming operation. Songson enjoys being part of the community and today farms with sons Travis and Shane. While many Vietnam veterans were often treated poorly upon their return, Songson said that didn't happen to him. "I did not have anything negative," Songson said. "People always treated me pretty good." He is grateful for Stratford, his family, and that his sons never had to serve, never had to see what he had to see. "Thank God they didn't have to do something like that," Songson said. Now turning to local obituaries. First, we remember Carol Jane Anderson Joslin. Carol Jane Anderson Joslin, age 82, passed away Friday, October 20th, in the comfort of her own home, surrounded by her family. A celebration of life will and memorial donation is planned for late spring 2024 in St. Louis, Missouri. Next, we remember Mary Lou Corwis. Mary Lou Corwis of Spirit Lake passed away peacefully at Acura Nursing Home in Spirit Lake on October 30th at the age of 87. A funeral service for Mary Lou will be held Saturday, November the 11th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Spirit Lake. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the service at the church. There will be a time of lunch and fellowship following the burial at St. Margaret's Cemetery in Spirit Lake. Next, we remember Margaret Shellhammer. Funeral services for Margaret will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 10th at the Methodist Church in West Bend. Visitation will be from 9 to 10 a.m. at the church. Lent's Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Next, we remember Betty Kelly. Elizabeth Marie, or Betty as she was known, Kelly, age 94, of Fort Dodge, passed away Sunday, November 5th at the Marion Home. A mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Friday, November 10th at Holy Trinity Church. Burial will follow at Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be Thursday, November 9th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Loffersweiler Funeral Home, with the CDA Rosary at 4 p.m. Next, we remember Marilyn Tim. Marilyn Tim, age 90, died Saturday, November 4th. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on Monday, November 13th at the Bowman Funeral Home. Next, we remember Dan Poshinsky. Dan Poshinsky, age 63, of Summers, passed away Monday, November 6th at his home. No services are planned at this time. The Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. And now turning to some Fort Dodge local sports headlines. This one reads, 6 Dodgers earn all-conference honors. McCaleb, unanimous first-team choice. McElrath, also on top squad. The Fort Dodge volleyball team had a memorable 2023 campaign, claiming the Iowa Alliance Conference Northern Division Championship along the way. For 6 Dodgers, that brought with it a number of all-league honors. Junior Mia McCaleb was one of 2 unanimous selections to the first team, along with Mason City's Megan Tobin. Fort Dodge Senior High senior Mackenzie McElrath joined her on the first squad, with Olivia Totten and Macy Brown on the second. It was great to see Mia recognized for her abilities. She was definitely deserving of top recognition, Fort Dodge Senior High head coach Lexi Astor said. Honestly, I was expecting a little more in terms of kids on the first team after winning the conference like we did. It felt like they didn't really take into account players outside of the pin hitters, and those are the ones with the big stats. It's like only naming the quarterback and not honoring the offensive or defensive line in football. You can't win without those players. Lucy Porter was named honorable mention for the Dodgers, who went a perfect 4-0 in the conference and 20-14 overall. McCaleb, one of just two juniors on the first team, ranked first in serve accuracy, second in digs, fourth in kills, and fifth in kills efficiency. She had 199 kills, with 280 digs and 45 aces. Mia played a lot of high-level club ball over the off-season, and it showed, Astor said. She is a good athlete and a coachable kid. Her hard work helped make sure she was prepared to have the kind of success she had. McElrath finished second in the North in kills, and Totten was first in assists. Brown was second in successful serves and fifth in digs. On the year, McElrath had a team high 218 kills with 23 blocks, 93 digs, and served at a 93% clip. Totten, also a senior, had 546 assists, 25 aces, 122 digs, and 47 kills. Brown, another member of the senior class with Sydney Gebbers, added 71 assists, 253 digs, and 34 aces, while Porter, a junior, had 105 kills, 26 blocks, 144 digs, and 28 aces. The 20 wins were the most for a Fort Dodge team since going 20-11 in 2009, and almost surpassed the combined win total of the past three seasons. The Dodgers also picked up their first postseason victory since 2009 as well. I've only known these girls for two seasons, but from the minute I stepped in, they bought into everything I had to offer them, Astor said. They were still growing points for me as a coach, but they were always willing to learn, and everyone wanted to get better. Along with McCaleb and Porter, junior classmates Braxton Denklau, Grace Behrens, and Cadence Tooney are slated to return in 2024, with sophomore LJ Mayle also back. And continuing with local sports headlines, we have this one that reads, Big Second Half Lifts Tritons. Down by two at the half, Sabah Dickerson asked for three things out of her Iowa Central women's team over the final 20 minutes. The Tritons paid attention and delivered, storming out of the break on their way to posting an 80-65 victory here Monday evening over Central Columbus. Lainey Pilcher led four players in double figures with 22, adding 8 steals and 7 rebounds. Caitlin Tendall scored 12, Alicia Hattelstad 11, and Fort Dodge senior high grad Lainey Mall 10 for Iowa Central, who are 2-0 overall. We've asked just three things out of them at halftime, Dickerson said. We are a very smart team with a high basketball IQ. I think that showed over the second half. We weren't hitting shots, and there are going to be nights when that happens. But if you can execute, drive to the basket, and limit your turnovers, you can overcome that. The Tritons outscored Central Columbus 26-11 during the third, as Pilcher took over the game. The freshman caused problems for the Raider defense with her ability to get to the basket, finishing 9-for-16 from the field. Lainey found a rhythm, Dickerson said. She had a few shots in the first half that just weren't dropping because she was avoiding the contact. When she started playing more physical, things turned around. When you can score 80, put four players in double figures, and shoot 44% from the field, that is a pretty good offensive night. Emily Teese had a game-high 11 rebounds with 4 assists for the Tritons, as Mall added 7 rebounds, 2 steals, and blocked shot. Alyssa Lux chipped in 8 points off the bench, and Olivia Miller grabbed 5 rebounds. For Central Columbus, Aubrey Salapaga had 20 points, and McKenna Pelster added 14. Iowa Central was plus 18 on points in the paint and scored 21 off of 18 Raider turnovers. After starting the year at home inside Hodgers Fieldhouse, the Tritons will now hit the road for 3 straight. They play in Kansas City at Hy-Vee Arena on Friday versus Metropolitan before taking on Kansas City, Kansas Saturday. Iowa Central travels to Central Columbus next Tuesday. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 7th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. And our first Mason City headline today reads, Surf Ballroom announces 2024 Winter Dance Party lineup. The historic Surf Ballroom and Museum has announced the lineup for the 2024 Winter Dance Party. The event will feature a jam-packed lineup that features a number of fan-favorite artists, as well as a multitude of musicians influenced by the late rock and roll pioneers, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson, according to a press release. The annual event pays tribute to the original Winter Dance Party, the Midwestern tour that came to a tragic end, as Holly, Valens, and Richardson, along with local pilot Roger Peterson, were killed in a plane crash after their February 2, 1959 performance at the Surf. This year's event will take place February 1st through the 3rd. Advance tickets will go on sale at 8 a.m. November 16th. Chris Montez, The Chiffons, Dodie Stevens, and The Killer V's will all take the stage on Thursday, February 1st, opening the event. The Chiffons, with their trademark tight harmonies, high-stepping confidence, and songs like One Fine Day and Sweet Talking Guy, are still staples of oldies radio today. The Killer V's, known in the music business as the Rhythm Section to the Stars, features brothers Jeff and Tommy V, who have been playing drums and doghouse bass, respectively, for almost 40 years on records for Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Paul McCartney, Ronnie Wood, Brian Seltzer, Chuck Berry, Bill Medley, and their father, Bobby V. Friday night's entertainment will feature Rocky and the Rollers, with special guests Lala Brooks, the voice of the Crystals, and Vito Picone, and the Elegants. Richie Lee and the Fabulous 50s will round out the evening. Saturday will open with the Holy Rock-a-Rollas, who became instant winter dance party favorites several years ago, when they thrilled a winter dance party luncheon, the Surf statement said. The high-energy trio performs classics from the 1950s and 60s and have become a stage favorite at the annual event. Saturday's lineup will include Albert Lee's 80th Birthday Jam, featuring special guests from around the globe. Albert has become synonymous with the Surf Ballroom's winter dance party, said Shane Cooley, Winter Dance Party executive producer. This year, we received so many inquiries from his contemporaries wanting to come to Clear Lake to help celebrate Albert's birthday while making a pilgrimage to share their music from the Surf Ballroom stage. The Lettermen, known for their 1961 hit, The Way You Look Tonight, will also perform Saturday, followed lastly by Slim Jim Phantom, whose all-star finale at the show's conclusion will combine the stars of the evening with additional special guests to blend the birthday celebration with a refocus upon the three stars that have brought them all together. Joining the others will be additional guests, Glenn Matlock, Gilby Clark, Jenny V, Austin Alsop, and Chris Montez. The three-day pass, good for all winter dance party activities held at the Surf Ballroom, will be $135 and is valid for the evenings of Thursday, February 1st through Saturday, February 3rd. Individual night general admission tickets will also be available for purchase. All tickets for the event are non-refundable, and the entertainment lineup is subject to change. Tickets and seating reservations may be purchased online at the Surf Ballroom's website or by calling the Surf's box office at 641-357-6151. For the most current information about the event, please visit winterdanceparty.surfballroom.com. Ticket orders and seating reservations are not accepted through the mail or by fax. Our next local headline reads, USDA's AXNE to announce ethanol grant during stop at Golden Grain Energy. Mason City ethanol producer Golden Grain Energy will receive a federal biofuels grant during a visit from U.S. Department of Agriculture official Cindy AXNE, according to a press release from the USDA. Highlighting the impact of higher blend fuels on the Iowa ag industry, the grant is designed to help to increase the availability of domestic biofuels, reduce reliance on foreign oil, and give Americans additional cleaner fuel options at the pump, according to the release. The press release did not indicate the investment's dollar amount, but continued, "This USDA investment reflects the Biden-Harris administration's efforts to advance rural prosperity, economic development, competition, and sustainability." AXNE is a senior advisor for rural engagement, delivery, and prosperity for the USDA, and is scheduled to bestow the investment in a short ceremony at the plant at 9:45 a.m. Tuesday, November 7th. Before joining the Biden administration, AXNE was a representative for Iowa's 3rd Congressional District in the U.S. House from 2019 to 2023. The Globe Gazette in 2022 profiled Golden Grain on the occasion of its 20th anniversary, reporting consistent growth since its inception. The plant produced 40 million gallons of ethanol annually in 2002, and in 20 years tripled that amount by 2022, producing around 135 million gallons a year. The plant is also home to the world's largest steel grain bin with 165-foot diameter and a capacity of storing 2.25 million bushels. The bin takes roughly 2,000 fully loaded trucks to fill. In 2022, Golden Grain Energy employed 58 people, according to CEO Chad Coolers. Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel said the ethanol plant is a big part of the local economy. Our next local headline reads, Mason City offices to close for Veterans Day holiday. Mason City offices will be closed Friday, November 10th in observance of the Veterans Day holiday. City transit buses will be operating that day, according to a press release. City sanitation services will not be collected on Friday, November 10th. The makeup day for garbage, yard waste, and recycling services for those that normally have pickup on Friday will be Wednesday, November 15th. For further information, contact the Sanitation Division at 641-421-3691 or the Transit Division at 641-421-3616. Our next Mason City headline reads, Young Construction donates roof to St. John Baptist Restoration Project. Young Construction in Mason City has donated the materials and labor to replace the roof at St. John Baptist Church, located at 715 6th Street Southwest. A committee has been working to restore the defunct church in order to reopen it to the community for weddings and events. A recent inspection found the structure itself is sound, with mainly cosmetic repairs needed beyond the issue of the roof. Workers arrived Wednesday to remove the old roof, place plyboard sheeting, and shingle it. Crews inspected the bell tower from the interior and determined that while the exterior needs attention, the bell housing is secure and strong. Giving back to the community is an important part of what we do, said Young Construction owner Tammy Young. She and husband Dan see their business as an opportunity to give back to those who may be in need. A roof can be a big project for families. We like giving them away. North Iowa Youth Center Director Reagan Banks is a former member of the St. John congregation and sits on the Restoration Committee. We got the deed and the abstract and put it under the North Iowa Youth Center's nonprofit for now. In a perfect world, we could bring back the breakfast program that ran here for so many years, he said. In 1971, volunteers began cooking breakfast for neighborhood students before school each morning. Cooks would arrive around 6 a.m. each school day to supply a meal for kids before they started their day. In the late 80s, as membership in the church declined, the breakfast program was discontinued. The committee is made up of former church members, the families of former pastors at St. John, community members, and skilled tradesmen willing to restore the building. Meetings are typically held at 6 p.m. on the second Wednesday of the month at the North Iowa Area Council of Governments, located at 525 6th Street Southwest in Mason City. Our next local headline reads, Dry Week Pushes Harvest Toward Conclusion. The dateline is Des Moines. Colder than normal temperatures but dry weather led to 6 days of suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Field work included harvesting corn and soybeans, completing fall tillage, applying fall fertilizer, baling stalks, and hauling manure. Corn and soybean harvest is beginning to wind down thanks to more agreeable weather, though there is still plenty of farm and field work left to finish up yet this fall, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig. While statewide drought remains a concern heading into the 2024 growing season, the bursts of October rain helped improve soil moisture in parts of northwestern and eastern Iowa, he said. Topsoil moisture condition rated 15% very short, 40% short, 44% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture condition rated 27% very short, 43% short, 29% adequate, and 1% surplus. Corn harvested for grain reached 89% statewide, a day ahead of last year, and 10 days ahead of the 5-year average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain was at 16%. Soybeans harvested reached 97%, on pace with last year, but 9 days ahead of the average. Livestock reports included calves being weaned and cattle being turned out into stock fields. A generally quiet weather pattern set up over Iowa as measurable precipitation was only reported at northern and southeastern stations, according to Justin Glissan, state climatologist with the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Unseasonably cold conditions also blanketed the upper Midwest, with negative departures of up to 10 degrees reported across southwestern Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 36.5 degrees, 7.5 degrees below normal. Weekly precipitation totals range from no accumulation at most of Iowa stations to 0.07 inches at stations in Allamakee and Winnesheek counties. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 0.03 inches, while the normal is 0.56 inches. Sioux City Airport in Woodbury County reported the week's high temperature of 64 degrees on the 4th, 11 degrees above normal. Audubon County reported the week's low temperature of 11 degrees on the 1st, 20 degrees below normal. And now turning to today's obituaries. First, we remember James Bamrick. James J., or Joe as he was known, Bamrick, age 98, of Rockwell, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on Wednesday, November 1st, after a brief illness. A mass of a Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 13th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, located at 305 Elm Street East in Rockwell, with Reverend Josh Link as the celebrant. Interment will be private at Sacred Heart Cemetery in Rockwell. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 12th at Sacred Heart Parish Center, Memorials may be directed to the family to be gifted in his name. Next, we remember Isla June Fish. Isla June Fish, age 100 of Mason City, passed away November 1st at the International Order of Odd Fellows home in Mason City. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, November 10th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, located at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Visitation will take place 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. Next, we remember Carol Gordon. Carol Gordon, age 79, passed away on November 2nd in Mason City. Arrangements are with the Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory in Mason City. We will be remembering the wonderful impact Carol had on many of us on Saturday, November the 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the funeral home. There will be a brief service in honor of Carol starting at 2 p.m. All are welcomed, followed by an open reception for family and friends. Cards may be sent to Martin Gordon in care of 14 North Willow Green Court in Mason City. Next, we remember Marjorie Hall. Marjorie A. Hall, age 101, of Forest City, passed away Thursday, October 19th at Concord Care Center in Garner. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, November the 11th at Cataldo Funeral Chapel, located at 160 East 4th Street in Garner, with Tyler Bragg officiating. Burial will follow at Madison Township Cemetery in Forest City. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the Cataldo Funeral Chapel. Memorials may be directed to Calvary Baptist Church Missionary Funds or Concord Care Center Family Donation Fund. For those choosing to send condolences, please direct them to the family of Marjorie Hall to the address 190 West 13th Street in Garner. Next, we remember William Mossey. William Joseph Mossey, age 68 of Clear Lake, passed away October 28th in Clear Lake. A memorial service celebrating Bill's life will be at 4 p.m. on Friday, November 10th at Park Lawn Northland Chapel, located at 1640 North State Route 291 in Liberty, Missouri. A visitation will be from 3 to 4 p.m. prior to the service at the funeral home. Memorial contributions may be sent to the Humane Society of North Iowa, located at 2700 South Birch Drive in Mason City. Next, we remember Leola Nedved. Leola M. Nedved, age 85, of Britt, passed away Sunday, October 29th in Britt. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November the 11th at First Lutheran Church in Britt. Burial will be in Evergreen Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, November 10th at Cataldo Funeral Home, located at 178 First Avenue Southwest in Britt. Next, we remember Marilyn D. Seward. It is with our deepest sadness that we share information on the passing of Marilyn D. Seward, born Austin, on September 5th. Our beloved mother passed away peacefully after a long battle with Alzheimer's dementia in the home she shared with her husband, Richard, for nearly 45 years. Marilyn will be laid to rest at Memorial Park Cemetery in West Mason City on Friday, November 10th at 11 a.m. Lunch will follow immediately at Village Court Family Restaurant, located at 687 South Taft Avenue in Mason City. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to two letters today. The first one has a headline, "Recording may be worth more than 1,000 words." They write, "Dear Abby, I have some advice for your readers who write regarding problems with how others behave badly or are verbally abusive or inappropriate toward them. Hopefully it will help someone. I suggest recording video of the offending individual while it's happening, and then showing them the video later when they are calm, sober, receptive. If the behavior is drug or alcohol driven, this can show the person they're not fun and funny, they are obnoxious and offensive. I'm certain I would have quit drinking years earlier had I been able to see how I acted while intoxicated. This advice could also work with a relative you are concerned about with regard to dementia or Alzheimer's. You should show the video to their doctor rather than make generalizations about their behavior. Telling your husband to talk to his mom about how critical or rude she is to you puts your husband on the spot, and it's still a she-said-she-said situation. Maybe your mother-in-law has no idea how she sounds, but she should. If a picture is worth a thousand words, a video is worth even more. And it's signed Gotcha in California. And Abby responds, "Dear Gotcha, I'm printing your letter because I think in some cases it has merit. However, videotaping someone who is in the middle of a rant or some other socially unacceptable activity could cause some individuals to become violent, saying things like, 'Stop videotaping me.' That's why I have to add that if one chooses to do this, they should be aware of the risk." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, Wife lives in home filled with yelling. And they write, "Dear Abby, I'm a 35-year-old woman who is married to a 27-year-old man. We currently live in the same house as his mother. She lives downstairs, we live upstairs. Thanks to my husband's upbringing, he has a hair trigger temper. His dad has an explosive temper, and his mother is a narcissist. He's never directed it at me, but his mother sets him off. Sometimes I think she does it on purpose because she has some kind of victim complex. I've tried everything to help him control his temper. Nothing has worked. It has become normal for me to end the day with them fighting. I'm exhausted by them. If they're home before I go to work, they get in some sort of yelling match. When I'm finishing my workday, he'll call me, and I'll hear them arguing on the phone. I'm tired of the fighting. It's creating so much anxiety and depression. I have told him this and asked him to at least try to stop, but it's still the same. What do I do?" And it's signed "Surrounded by War in Texas." And Abby replies, "Dear Surrounded, you are more mature than your husband, both emotionally and chronologically. He is still under his mother's thumb, which is why she's so good at pushing his buttons. It is time for you both to move as far away from his mother's dwelling as possible. If you do, he will have less exposure to his mother, and you may have peace under your roof once you unplug the phone." And returning to local news, we have this headline: "Waterloo man facing drug theft charges in Cerro Gordo pleads not guilty." A Waterloo man arrested in October in Mason City has pleaded not guilty to drug theft and OWI charges. According to court records, 27-year-old Brody Allen Buck was pulled over in a 2014 Chevy Silverado 1500 around 10:20 a.m. near the intersection of North Pennsylvania Avenue and 13th Street Northeast. He is facing up to 16 years in prison if convicted of first-degree theft, possession of marijuana, driving while barred, and second offense OWI. Court records state Buck had bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, and smelled of alcohol. He allegedly admitted to drinking around 5 a.m. Open containers were also found inside the vehicle. He eventually provided a breath sample of 0.138 BAC, which is over the legal limit of 0.08. Buck allegedly told the state trooper that a friend gave him the truck to drive from Cedar Falls to Mason City to enter treatment. The truck is not registered to Buck or his friend. Buck said something was fishy with the truck based on how his friend was talking to him about it. The Kelley Blue Book value of the truck is set between $17,000 and $20,000. Marijuana was allegedly found in Buck's pant pocket, along with multiple pipes containing marijuana and methamphetamine residue. And as there's no local sports headlines today, we'll just move to some national news. This headline reads, Wall Street drifts to a mixed and quiet finish after last week's big swings. Dateline is New York. U.S. stocks drifted to a mixed finish Monday as Wall Street's wild recent moves calmed a bit. The S&P 500 added 7.64 points, or 0.2%, to 4,365.98, even though the majority of stocks within it and across Wall Street weakened. The index was coming off its best week of the year, which itself came on the heels of several months of sharp losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 34.54, or 0.1%, to 34,095.86, and the NASDAQ Composite gained 40.50, or 0.3%, to 13,518.78. The flashpoint for the stock market's movements in both directions has been what the bond market is doing, and it regressed Monday following its own extreme moves. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 4.64%. That's up from 4.57% late Friday, but it's still below the perch above 5% that it reached last month, its highest level since 2007. This upcoming week looks to have fewer big events on the calendar that could shake financial markets. It's a slower week for corporate profit reports, with roughly 50 companies in the S&P 500 set to say how much they earned during the summer. That's down from about 150 a week before. Even more companies than usual in the S&P 500 have been beating Wall Street profit forecasts this reporting season. The index looks to be on pace to deliver its first growth in earnings per share in a year. The events with perhaps the most potential to shake markets this upcoming week are speeches on the schedule by officials from the Federal Reserve. Last week, the Federal Reserve held its main interest rate steady for a second straight time, leaving it at its highest level since 2001. It's jacked up its federal funds rate from nearly zero in hopes of getting high inflation under control. Perhaps more importantly for markets, Federal Chair Jerome Powell also hinted that a swift rise in Treasury yields since the summer and the tumult that created in financial markets could act as substitutes for further hikes to rates if they remain persistent. That's because they could be slowing the economy and putting downward pressure on the economy by themselves. A report from the Federal Reserve Monday said that significant numbers of loan officers at banks reported tightening their standards to lend money. Many banks cited a less favorable or more uncertain outlook on the economy. A slowdown in lending could tap the brakes further on the economy. At the end of this week will come a preliminary report showing how much inflation U.S. households are preparing for. Such inflation expectations have been key for the Fed, which fears too high expectations could trigger a vicious cycle that keeps inflation high. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 7th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.